Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Lake Coal Company against Roberts.
You know, that last case, that guy said the writs weren't issued. Here's the magistrate saying, I issued writs of habeas corpus ad testamentum. And the writs directed that. So just as part of the writs, he put this order.
Mr. Pauley.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue in this matter is whether exceptional circumstances exist to justify the stay deferring to the concurrent state action in this pure diversity action. In the San Carlos Apache case, the dismissal was upheld because the state suits were adequate to quantify the rights, water rights of the Indians. Number two, the McCarran Amendment policies are relevant. Number three, the state expertise and administrative machinery is adequate and set up. The infancy of the federal suits, particularly the judicial bias against piecemeal litigation and convenience to the parties involving duplication of issues and effort. The reasoning mentioned there to some great extent was that the concurrent federal proceedings are duplicative and wasteful, generating additional litigation through inconsistent disposition of property. And number two, the concurrent proceedings create the serious potential for spawning an unseemly and destructive race to see which forum can resolve the same issues first, prejudicial to the possibility of reasoned decision-making by either forum. In the Moses Cohn Hospital case, the stay reversal was affirmed because the piecemeal litigation was not avoided as to the architect in the state court. The priority measured by progress in the suits was not in favor of stay. The federal law was the rule of decision on the merits, and the state court action was inadequate to protect the rights. The court.
Mr. Pauley, what has happened to the state court action now? It proceeded, I understood.
The state court action is set for trial November the 4th.
I see.
The court was guided in the Moses Cohn case by the federal policy and law to not delay arbitration under the Federal Arbitration Act. The court noted specifically that vexatious or reactive nature of suits may influence the decision as to whether to defer to the concurrent state actions. This occurred not only in the Moses Cohn case in the Court of Appeals, but also in the Calvert case, and was mentioned by this court as having considerable merit. In the Colorado River case, the dismissal was upheld because the McCarran Amendment federal policy to avoid piecemeal litigation of water rights in a river system. Number two, the absence of proceedings beyond the complaint. Number three, particularly the extensive involvement of state water rights involving numerous defendants, and the distance between state court in Denver and the Division 7 location of the site of the water rights. And number five, the existing participation of U.S. in other similar state proceedings. There, the particular language relating to the basis for justifying the state the stay derives. The court said that the issue must be decided on the basis of wise judicial administration, giving regard to conservation of judicial resources and comprehensive disposition of litigation. The court noted the virtual unflagging obligation to exercise jurisdiction. The court also noted that the reasons of wise judicial administration are more limited and exceptional. And the court indicated that there must be a weighing of factors with only the clearest of justifications. The scales were described as consider the obligation to exercise as opposed to factors counseling against exercise. The factors in this case are, number one, the priority of assuming jurisdiction of property, the question of in rem application. This question has never been specifically an issue. Robertson Schaefer says the state action is in personam. And I simply point out that that was deliberately so by Robertson Schaefer.
What do you think the court should have done if Roberts had gone to the federal court first? It started a suit and started the litigation, and then Lake Cole counterclaimed in the federal court, and then Lake Cole went to the state court and started a suit.
Justice White, I believe that the cases indicate that it would not matter if the same circumstances exist.
After the suit starts in the federal court, Lake Cole starts a case of its own in the state court and then moves the federal court to dismiss. Should this federal court grant that?
The existence of the state action, it is assumed that Lake would file the state action as well after the federal action. Mm-hmm. So the order in which the two were filed does not determine.
So in my example, you would be arguing for the same result, namely the federal court should dismiss the action.
So long as, yes, Mr. Justice White.
All right.
So long as the piecemeal litigation situation exists in the state court where the subcontractors are parties and they are not parties in the federal court action. I pointed out that the in rem question.
Well, what if there weren't subcontractors who were parties to the state action? And the federal court action is filed first.
I think in that event we do not have piecemeal litigation questions, and in all likelihood the federal action would stand.
Even though only state issues were involved?
Yes.
So in this case, except for the other parties that were in the state suit, if they hadn't been made parties in the state suit, but the federal court case was started later, you would think the federal court case could go ahead. Is that it?
Well, I think there is argument under the cases for the position that the federal court, under the test, because state law applies and all the other factors indicate in favor of stay, I think that it could be decided in that manner in the discretion of the court.
Do you think the removal power is a factor to be considered, whether or not an action in the state court could be removed to the federal court?
I think yes. I think one of the cases indicated that, lower court cases, in fact, where removal was possible, it was more indicated that the federal action should be stayed. because there, instead of filing a separate suit, removal could have been achieved.
Where the subcontractors are parties in the state court action, in this case, no removal is possible under the federal removal statute. Is that right?
That's correct, Justice O'Connor. The point is that R&S attempted removal, and the federal court remanded the case to the state court. And then 6 months after the state court action was filed, the second federal court action was filed by Robertson Schaefer. There is indication here of defensive tactical maneuvers on the part of Robertson Schaefer. Occupy Lake with the removal. Then when the removal fails, attempt a second action. I started to point out before the questions were asked that with respect to NREM, Robertson Schaefer deliberately did not file its LIN in its counterclaim in the state court and did not amend that counterclaim until after the district judge had ruled.
Mr. Pauley, I take it from one of your answers to one of Justice White's questions, tell me if I'm wrong in saying I take it that you would agree that there is a fair amount of discretion in the district court, that he might decide to stay the federal action, he might not decide to stay the federal action, and conceivably he could be properly affirmed by the Court of Appeals, whichever thing he did.
I think that's the case, Justice Rehnquist. Yes, I think that's the case. The indication, excuse me.
The court had refused to dismiss the case in this case. He dismissed, didn't he?
Yes, he stayed.
Yeah, he stayed. He didn't dismiss.
No.
He stayed.
He stayed.
What if he had refused to stay?
I think that would have been subject to appeal as well.
Well, I know, but I thought you mean that would not — he would not have had the discretion to entertain the suit. He would have had to stay.
In my opinion, yes, he had to stay because of the circumstances of the piecemeal litigation in the state court.
So his discretion,
now,
his discretion would not have extended so far as not to stay in this case.
No, no. I mean, that's very clear under these cases. The question, as I understood from Justice Rehnquist, right, was, setting aside the piecemeal litigation question, did the federal court have discretion without piecemeal litigation? That's the question I thought was being asked.
Right.
Now, when you say, what indication is there of vexation and reactive tactical defensive maneuvers, it's quite obvious that when the in-realm part of this case was deliberately avoided, although that question never was specifically in point in this case because the counterclaim in the state court did not incorporate the LIN that was incorporated in the federal action. But certainly as soon as the district judge made his decision, the counterclaim was amended by Robertson Schaefer to include the LIN. The judge made the decision in July, and immediately after he made the decision, in July, the amended counterclaim was filed. I don't think that my opposition will deny that. But nevertheless, that's not the basis for the district judge's decision. The second issue is whether there was any inconvenience of the federal forum. And we don't indicate any inconvenience in this case. The federal forum is in the adjoining county. A similar mountain county. In fact, where the Hatfield and McCoy feud that Mr. Combs speaks about in his brief occurred.
Where is the site of the nearest federal courthouse to
Pikeville, Kentucky. Pike County, which is just adjacent and in as deep of the mountains as Letcher County is. What Robertson Schaefer expected to achieve in its claim of late claim of saying, well, we have the basis here of imagined prejudice in the local court. The trial in the federal court would be the same with respect to the jury.
Well, now, I talked to one of your colleagues in Kentucky who had argued Thermtron here and asked him once after Thermtron was decided why he was interested in getting into a federal court rather than the Kentucky state court. And he said in a federal court, you can draw your jurors from a large part of the state, whereas if you're in state court, it's just the particular county you're in.
Well, particular county and state court, but in a large part of the same locale in federal court. In other words, come from other counties. As I understood it, the Robertson Schaefer's comments about the Hatfield-McCoy feud was almost as if he's going to get a different makeup in his jury down at federal court. That's not true. The third question is the priority of the progress of the suits, and of course that's not at issue in this case at the time the decision was made by the district court, but we do know now that the progress of the state suit is relevant in terms of practical application in this case.
When is that suit set for trial?
November the 4th of this year. The primary, as I have indicated, the primary basis for upholding the stay in this case is the avoidance of piecemeal litigation. Clearly, the subcontractors are defendants in the state action and not the federal action. There are issues that require the same proof as would be in the federal action. The federal action would in no wise dispose of that question with respect to the subcontractors. And the same proof would have to be introduced again by the same parties and cause, obviously, piecemeal litigation.
Mr. Pauley, suppose you proceed with the state litigation next month and it goes to judgment. Does this case become moot?
Justice Blackmun, in my opinion, it does. The state action would be res judicata, so long as, if this case were affirmed, if the Robertson Schaefer attorney could not obtain quick action by the district judge to attempt to get an adjudication there on a summary judgment motion, if summary judgment was rendered before November 4. Then the state action would be moot.
Well, but certainly there's an appeal from the Circuit Court of Letcher County within the Kentucky judicial system, isn't
there? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In the sense of res judicata, assuming that the state court action is upheld in the appeal. I mean, we were discussing, as I understood it, Justice Rehnquist, that the state court action is decided. To me, that means final. If it is finally decided, it is res judicata. Of course, if the trial verdict was appealed and reversed, then I think certainly, there's no question, but the decision of this court is very relevant and in no wise moot.
Which would be res judicata if the Kentucky trial proceedings ended first, but the federal court went ahead, say they vacated the stay or something, and the federal appellate process ran its course first? Would the federal case then be res judicata? I don't know how fast your Kentucky appellate process works, but assume it's slower than the federal.
Right. In my opinion, Justice Stevens, once a verdict is rendered in the state court, that judgment becomes res judicata with respect to the federal proceedings and would change the federal proceedings.
Even though it's on appeal?
The federal proceedings would not even be subject to appeal at that.
No. I mean, even if the state court judgment
is not final in the sense that there's review pending in the appellate courts of Kentucky.
I think, yes, the res judicata effect of the state court judgment coming first would affect the federal proceedings in terms of a stay at that point based on the decision there. The Court of Appeals in this case held that piecemeal litigation is not involved because Lake has shown no arguably valid claim against the non-signatory subcontractors. I point out to you that that's not the issue. That issue was never argued in any of the briefs, was never presented. No cases were cited by either side. And the Court of Appeals simply got the wrong issue. The point is that the case exists in state court against the subcontractors in the first place. It's not a question of whether you have an arguably valid claim against the subcontractors, but whether or not that claim exists in state court. And in the second place, in our petition for reconsideration, we pointed out to the court that certainly under state law we have an arguably valid claim against the subcontractors based on third-party beneficiary law and the alternative cause of action in the state court of negligence of the subcontractors. My point was how, when the judge asked me the question about the arguably valid claim, my statement was, how can you imagine that a subcontractor can come in and make a mess of a wash plant, construct it defectively, and not have liability to the people that own the wash plant and is having the work done? And that's the cause of action. But that's not the point. That question was raised on the removal action and was turned down by the district judge, exhaustively briefed. The point in the removal action was an issue, but not on the issue of whether or not there were exceptional circumstances to justify the stay. The Court of Appeals further says that piecemeal litigation will not be avoided because R&S could file separate actions against the subcontractors. And R&S adds that Lake can file a third-party complaint in the federal action against the subcontractors. I point out to you that these are imaginary cases as opposed to the reality of the present circumstances. It is not in this case which cases may be filed, but rather what cases have been filed. And on the basis of the cases that exist, this court should make a decision with respect to piecemeal litigation whether it satisfactorily justifies the stay in view of all the other circumstances.
You lost on the piecemeal litigation factor in the Court of Appeals.
That's correct.
They said they didn't think there would be piecemeal litigation.
No.
Do we have to second-guess that?
No, Justice White. I don't think that's what the Court of Appeals said. The Court of Appeals said, number one, that piecemeal litigation is not involved because Lake does not have an arguably valid claim in state court against the subcontractors. If we have an arguably valid claim, or if arguably valid claim is not relevant, then piecemeal litigation, that's the basis for the Court of Appeals. They didn't say piecemeal litigation didn't occur under the present circumstances if we have an arguably valid claim.
Well, I know, but they said you didn't
have an arguably valid claim.
Yeah, well, do we have to second-guess that?
My point is that that's not the issue. The issue is that we do have a case in state court. And number two,
I know the issue is one of the factors you consider is whether piecemeal litigation will be created.
Exactly. No. And we have a case.
And the Court of Appeals concluded that no, it would not.
The Court of Appeals concluded that we did not have an arguably valid
claim. And therefore, there's no piecemeal litigation.
Exactly. And my statement to you is that that ruling by the Court of Appeals was not the issue. The issue is whether or not the case exists, not whether we have an arguably valid claim. The case does exist.
If the Court of Appeals had thought piecemeal litigation would occur, they might have said, stay the case. But
yes,
they didn't.
But their reasons, the reasoning they gave as to saying that piecemeal litigation did not occur, were not an issue.
Well, Mr. Polly, can a plaintiff in the state court action just name anyone who's a resident of the state, however fraudulently, and thereby defeat the right of someone to remove to federal court?
No, Justice O'Connor. That's not the point. The point is that we have the case in state court in the first place. And it is not.
But why can't the district court look at whether there's a fraudulent joinder of someone in the state court action?
I pointed out, Justice O'Connor, that the district judge did do that on removal. But the question was not raised in the issue of stay. And the Court of Appeals sidetracked to that issue when it was not even in the case. And there was no briefing on it. To just come right out of the blue and say you don't have a valid cause of action.
Are you saying that the Court of Appeals took a contrary view to the district court when the district court remanded? Or what were the arguments made to the district court as to the grounds for removal and remanding? Was a fraudulent joinder point argued there?
Yes, the fraudulent joinder that we had no valid cause of action.
But the district court remanded?
Absolutely. Said that we did have an arguably valid claim and that that was for decision by the state court. And my point has been that that's not an issue in the Court of Appeals on the state. The rule of decision on the merits, federal law as opposed to state law, obviously state law is strictly involved, and the adequacy of the state action to protect the rights, there is no specific indication of prejudice here. Certainly the state action under all the cases is adequate to protect the rights, and that matter was not at issue. The district court's findings for the stay were that in fairness to the parties and to avoid multiplicity of judicial time and effort and piecemeal litigation, the stay was entered. The district court also found that there was no good cause shown to litigate in both courts, simply saying, as in all these cases, that there were no countervailing reasons to outweigh proceeding, adjudicating, as opposed to the stay. In other words, that there were no countervailing reasons, such as federal question involved, such as in the Moses Cone case, where the Arbitration Act demonstrated a federal policy that guided the decision. Mr. Chief Justice, with your permission, I reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Mr. Combs.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. At the outset, I would like to make it clear that Robertson Schaefer initially perceived its right to a federal forum when this action was first initiated in the state court. We have pursued that view diligently right up to this court. We sought to remove for the very reason Mr. Polly mentioned. We certainly did not want to leave any stone unturned and waive that right. We did not, upon remand, we immediately followed this court's admonition in Colorado River. Moses H. Cohn instituted a separate federal action to exercise our right to a federal form, which we conceived was granted to us by the Congress.
Mr. Combs, aren't the concerns that are reflected by diversity jurisdiction power satisfied fully by the option of removing a case that's been filed in state court to a federal court under the removal power of the statute? And if it turns out that removal is not possible because of the absence of diversity, complete diversity in the state case, do you think Congress still intended that the defendant who can't remove should be able to exercise diversity jurisdiction in the federal court?
Well, I certainly do, Your Honor, and I think this court has so held in a number of cases. I don't know that that factual situation is true, but
I'm not sure that this court has ruled on that, actually.
I don't know of any instance where that particular factual situation has existed, but the rule of concurrent jurisdiction, the pending of parallel suits in state and federal courts has been in existence for further back than I'd like to conceive.
But shouldn't we look at what Congress has addressed in the framework of the removal power and the diversity jurisdiction statute? Look at them together, because Congress has spoken to both issues, and don't they relate to each other?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because as was pointed out a moment ago, lawyers are a rather ingenious group, and many procedural situations can be developed to defeat diversity jurisdiction, as was true in this case. And the mere defeat of removal jurisdiction does not mean that the Congress did not intend for that participant, that party, that citizen of another state, not to have a right to a federal form.
Well, what if removal had been possible under the circumstances of the case? Suppose no subcontractors had been named, but instead of removing the action to the nearest federal court in Kentucky, you had instead instituted a new diversity action in the federal court in Illinois to be closer to your corporate headquarters. Would that have been all right, too, in your view?
There we have the Microsoft case, I believe it is. I think the action in Illinois would be permissible as concurrent federal jurisdiction, but we have a tool that could deal with that, and that is the right to transfer that case to the most convenient forum, which I take it would be its return to Pikeville. I would see no reason to dismiss or even stay that case, but just simply transfer it to Pikeville. At least that would be my thinking on it, Your Honor. Now, the problem that I'm having, the initial problem, and it's the problem that bothered the Court of Appeals, was the shifting of the burden. The district court imposed upon Roberts and Schaefer the burden of showing good cause for exercising a right to a federal forum granted by the Congress. And In our view, a right to a federal forum granted by the Congress, federal jurisdiction, is not subject to any presumption which must be overcome. The Court of Appeals so held, and we suggest that that's the proper rule.
Mr. Combs, can I ask you a question that's related to what Justice O'Connor was asking you? You contend, as I understand it, and you persuaded the Court of Appeals, that there was no arguably valid claim involving the subcontractors.
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
Now, if you had been successful in persuading the district court of that effect at the time of your effort to remove, would you not have been successful in removing?
We think so, Your Honor. That's why we asserted it.
Then does it not appear that the effect of what you've done is to get appellate review of the district court's, what you would say, erroneous decision on removal?
I suggest not, Your Honor, because if there is parallel federal jurisdiction, concurrent jurisdiction, this case is a case which was instituted in the federal courts under a statute granting us a federal forum. And the appeal is from that order and not from the other.
But is it not true that if, or isn't that probable at least, that if the Court of Appeals had agreed with the district court's remand order and thought that these parties were genuine, there was a genuine separate lawsuit against the two subcontractors, it would have decided the appeal differently? It seems to me the whole question of where you litigate turns on the bona fides of the claim against the subcontractors.
I don't really think it does, Your Honor, because certainly the question of the subcontractors is that the main thrust of this case and this claim really is this contract between these two parties that we have before us here today, and the question is Roberts and Schaefer's right to a federal forum by virtue of diversity to determine that controversy. And I don't think that what you're referring to, I take it, is whether that is sufficient exceptional circumstances. I submit that it is not.
Well, what's troubling me, it seems to me that Congress has given us conflicting signals. On the one hand, they say you've got a right to a federal forum in a diversity case. On the other hand, they say if you try to remove and you fail, you don't get any appeal from that, from an order denying removal or remanding the case.
And that would be the effect, actually, if that were held. Then we would be denied on both ends of the spectrum. We would be denied relief both ways, and it would have been ridiculous for me to attempt to remove. I should have just gone ahead and immediately filed.
Well, it wouldn't have been ridiculous, but it would, in effect, would say that a decision on a question like this is lodged in the district court, and basically it's not normally going to be reviewable. And that you happen to lose there, whereas maybe a different district judge would have decided it otherwise. And I think there's a close question on your removal. It's not perfectly clear he was right in denying your removal.
I think that's true, Your Honor. And I'd like to point out that the heavy burden was on Lake Coal Company. If they wanted a stay, the heavy burden was to come in and establish in the record that this would cause multiplicity of litigation. And the record is virtually silent on that. As a matter of fact, it is silent. That burden was not carried. And the Court of Appeals recognized that and spoke to it and held expressly that it was not met. And we think the Court of Appeals put that to rest at that point. There's no claim of abstention here. We don't have any Burford claim. We don't have any Younger claim. We do have an exceptional circumstances claim. The in personam was addressed, but actually what was addressed is merely a lien. And as we know, the point where a federal court draws the line and refuses to act in a race case is where the race, the property, is in the actual possession of a state court and is being administered by the state court. Certainly, under those circumstances, a federal court should and will abstain.
But what if the stay in the federal court had not been granted? I take it your position would be that the two suits should go on simultaneously?
Yes, Your Honor.
Litigating the same issue in each court, and whoever, whichever court arrived at judgment first would then conclude the other.
You would have the proverbial race to the judgment. We had a race to the courthouse, and I lost. Mm-hmm. I guess we'd have a race to the judgment.
Mm-hmm. Well, does that seem to you like a sensible way to run a judicial system?
No, Your Honor, but we do have the federal system, and...
Well, if you say, no, it's not a sensible way to run a judicial system, then there must be something wrong with the doctrines you're urging that say that's what should have happened.
I think the compelling issue is whether a litigant is entitled to a federal forum.
You say he's entitled to a federal forum come hell or high water, regardless of totally duplicative litigation in the state court.
I suggest, Your Honor, that is a political argument, as most of these things are, that and really addresses itself to the Congress.
And you think Congress would have been deeply pleased with the spectacle of litigation, identical litigation, running its course both in the Kentucky State Court and in the federal district court?
I would hope the Congress would not be pleased, Your Honor. But then my remedy, the only remedy that I know, is to write my congressman, because the jurisdiction of the federal courts is vested exclusively in the Congress. And I'd like to speak to that later.
Well, don't you think the congressman might respond and tell you, we have spoken and we've written the removal statute and it's linked to the diversity statute, and we've denied the right of appeal from an order under the removal power, and that's it, we've spoken. Now, you courts have to implement these statutes together and make them work.
Your Honor, I don't read the original diversity statute and the removal diversity statute as being, you can choose one or the other.
Well, read them together. I mean, is there anything wrong with that and with the argument that indeed Congress had a right to speak and it did speak?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm having trouble following your last question.
It was more a comment than a question. Thank you.
Well, I'm suggesting that the Congress has said you may remove if it's removable. If it's not, and you have diversity jurisdiction otherwise, you may institute a separate parallel proceeding. That is what we have done. And we suggest that once the Congress determines that jurisdiction does exist, that there is the often spoken unflagging obligation to proceed, and we think that is what should have happened in this case. Now, I'd like to address for a moment, if I may, the exceptional circumstances situation. And I'm troubled by exceptional circumstances, because they're in the eye of the beholder. It all depends on whose circumstances they are. And it becomes entangled and enmeshed with discretion. And I recognize that for a lawyer to address a court and suggest that there is no discretion is hazardous at best. But I suggest that constitutionally there is no discretion with regard to jurisdiction. Discretion is an innate part of jurisdiction. Jurisdiction, in my view, is a mandate to a court to act and adjudicate an adjudicable controversy. That's what we have here.
Mr. Combs, you said that you thought constitutionally there could be no discretion. Do you mean that Congress could not have said when it passed the statutes conferring jurisdiction on the district courts that the district court should have jurisdiction to stay the case where there would be duplicative litigation?
I think they could very well have done so, Your Honor. And maybe that's the answer. But there again, that's a political decision.
Yeah, but anyway, it's not any constitutional doctrine that the Congress couldn't have achieved this.
No. What I'm saying is that there is presently a constitutional prohibition against exercising a discretion.
Where do we find that in the Constitution?
You find it in the area where matters of jurisdiction are withheld and granted to the Congress. And when the Congress determines jurisdiction, the Congress determines whether jurisdiction shall exist in this case, whether the jurisdiction shall not exist in the next case, whether it shall exist with discretion to stay in the third case. In other words, the entire spectrum of jurisdictional power rests with the Congress and not with any court.
So in your view, cases from this court like the Younger or Pullman abstention cases are all erroneously decided?
No, Your Honor, but...
And the Colorado River Factors case as well.
Addressing that specifically, I view... Of course, Younger, Burford, and the other abstention cases are bottomed on the concept of the separation of the federal government, the state government, the operation of the state government, the non-interference, the non-intrusion of the federal government into the vital affairs of the state. And I agree with those cases. Now, where I start having a little trouble is with Colorado River and Arizona. Because in Colorado River and in Arizona, the court used the exceptional circumstances test. In my mind, exceptional circumstances is almost tantamount to discretion. May be discretion, although the court very pointedly says that it's the narrowest of discretion. And again, I'm back to the constitutional problem, the jurisdictional problem of discretion. Certainly in the Declaratory Judgment Act, the Billard case, the Congress granted the discretion, and the court exercised it, and this court upheld it. So I would suggest that Colorado River and Arizona maybe are closer kin, or what we in Kentucky call kissing cousins, of Burford and some of the civil counterparts of Younger. Where the state has a vital interest, because having practiced for a short time in Arizona, I know what water rights mean. And as this court pointed out, in Arizona, that's a very I forget the terminology, but it's unique. And here, Colorado and Arizona were attempting to establish through the state court system a pattern of water rights, which this court held provided exceptional circumstances. I would suggest
that may be more appropriate. It should have been intrusion into areas that should be reserved for the states. And I would suggest that that if I don't think it's a discretion, but I think the federal courts, when they come into an area of that sort, they should look into it and make a determination, a finding of fact, if you please, not a discretion, but a finding of fact as to whether there will be an intrusion into the vital functions of the state, which might well be contrary to the comity between the federal government and the states. Now, the state law issue, I think, should be put to rest. I think can be put to rest very quickly. That's what Erie is all about. That's what the diversity statute is all about. If we were to stay every case, because it's based on state law, we would repeal the diversity statute, and we all know that that's an area reserved to the Congress. Conservation of judicial time. That's extremely interesting to me because 10 years ago, this very month, I was standing here, same spot, defending Judge Hermersdorfer. And Judge Hermersdorfer didn't have time. And he was serious. And he meant it. But this court wisely determined that the Congress had spoken, that the conferring of jurisdiction in diversity removal cases was a mandate of the Congress, which he should have heeded, and ordered him to heed it. Certainly, these things are sometimes wasteful, waste of time, waste of money. Maybe there should be better ways. But again, that addresses itself to the Congress and not to us. Another thing that bothers me is, oh, it's the microsoftware case that I mentioned a moment ago, and I misnamed it. Another matter I'd like to cover briefly is diversity jurisdiction and its relationship to federal questions, civil rights, whatever. I mentioned in my brief, and I'd like to emphasize now, that I know of no jurisdictional pecking order. I know of no jurisdictional statute that says diversity shall be tried first, second, or third, whether it should be number one or number 10 on the list of 1 to 10. And I think that in the absence of a congressional expression, we must treat each conferring of jurisdiction as a congressional mandate of at least equal equality. The jurisdiction that I advocate today happens to be a senior citizen, the most senior of all, I suppose. The mere fact that it may have been here and may not even be in great favor in a lot of places doesn't mean that it's to be condemned or moved to the back of the bus. Certainly, as a senior citizen, it's entitled to as much consideration. And is entitled to go forward with at least the same deliberate speed to adjudication as any other jurisdiction, unless the Congress mandates otherwise, as it has in a few instances. It distresses me to see judgments made by the individual districts or even the circuits as to which should take precedence, which should be first, which should be second, which should be ninth, which should be tenth. I think that's a political decision for the Congress and not for the courts, and I would suggest that all jurisdictional mandates move forward equally unless and until the Congress dictates otherwise. I notice the Colorado District in Local Rule 200 says that that diversity actions will be given the lowest priority and will be heard and tried when, as, and if time permits. Again, I suggest that's a judgment for the Congress and not for the courts. I'm suggesting that the Sixth Circuit has has decided the case correctly, has decided that the congressional mandate of the Congress should be enforced, and has properly reversed the district court with directions to exercise jurisdiction. If the court has nothing further, may I be excused.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Pauley?
I wish first to say again, with respect to the piecemeal litigation issue and the finding by the Court of Appeals that Lake did not have an arguably valid claim against the subcontractors and therefore there was no piecemeal litigation. Let me point out to this Court that the district judge in this case found that piecemeal litigation exists. Not only did the Court of Appeals find that it did not exist, but the district judge found that it did exist specifically in his stay order. The question is not whether the Court of Appeals made that finding and could make that finding. The question is whether or not the Court of Appeals is correct. The issue is whether or not the district judge abused his discretion in finding that piecemeal litigation occurred. And yes, this Court must determine whether or not the Court of Appeals was correct in ruling that the district judge abused his discretion in finding that piecemeal litigation exists. The district judge, it must be realized, impliedly found in the stay request that Lake had an arguably valid claim against the subcontractors.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you,
gentlemen. The case is submitted.